Welcome to the Inside CCW Safe Podcast with founders Stan Campbell and Mike Darter. If you're forced to fight the battle for your life, CCW Safe will fight the battle for your future.
All right, welcome back to the Inside CCW Safe Podcast. I'm Mike Darter in Oklahoma City, here with Stan Campbell.
That's right, Stan Campbell in the beautiful Los Angeles right now.
Back home, man. It's been a while.
Yeah, finally got some good weather, too. Thank you. It's freezing here.
I don't know if this polar vortex is pushing down, but it's not good here. And I'm headed to Yellowstone next week, and, man, it's looking like it's going to be freezing, like minus.
Yeah, you can have all that, and I'll hold down the fort for you, so everything will be just fine.
They get dumped on with snow.
Yeah, that's horrible.
So, how's Mama Mona doing, man?
Mama Mona's doing well. You know, she likes people, so she started driving Uber, right?
Really?
And, yeah, so she had a suspicious guy get in her car yesterday. So I got that phone call.
Really? She's driving Uber.
Yeah, she's driving Uber. And she wants
to
get out there and do her thing. So, yeah, so, you know, she called and we talked about, I already knew in her voice that something was going wrong. And so I can hear the guy and he just happened to jump in her front seat and she was nervous. And she's like, yeah, I still got somebody in my car, but we're trying to find out where they're going because I can't find it. So, you know, I can tell something's going on. So I say, hey, where are you? So she says, well, I'm right at this intersection. I said, okay. And where are you trying to go? So I pulled up the location. And so the guy asked her, who's on the phone with you? And she says, my son. And I go, hello, mister. I'm like, letting you know, that's right. I'm on the phone and I know where you are. So we ended up having, she was really scared. She was shaking up. So we get him out of the car. No big deal. I stayed on the phone with her. But then we came up with, you know, I immediately, you know, jump into, okay, let's get you a GPS app, a family app, so that I can know where you are and you can check in and stuff. Mm-hmm. So now we got to add that to the security plan. So
yeah, my 360 is a pretty good app.
Hey, that's the one I got.
Hey, is that the one you had? Nice.
Yes.
Nice.
Yeah, but that's it. So she's doing okay otherwise, because now I know where she is, and if there's a problem, we're going to handle it.
Yeah.
So.
And don't mess with mom.
Don't mess with my mom.
Do not mess with Mama Mona.
But anyway, we got a special guest today.
Yes, we do. We have Dave Spaulding online. Dave, how you doing?
I'm doing quite well. Yourself?
Good. And where are you at, Dave, based out of?
I'm in Dayton, Ohio.
In Ohio. We're going to talk today. Dave is one of the leading trainers in the firearms industry, kind of with a special background, the law enforcement background. Dave, do you mind just kind of giving people a quick rundown of your background?
No, sure. I entered law enforcement in 1976 by, like most guys, going into the basic police academy. And then because I worked for a sheriff's office, we have a correctional component. And at that time, new deputies worked the jail until there was a spot on the road. So I spent the first couple of years working in the jail amongst prisoners and never really cared for jail duty. But I came to realize many years later, it was one of the better things I ever did because it gave me the opportunity to actually communicate and interact with my potential enemy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I went to patrol. And then I did all the various things. I tried to do all the action stuff I could. You know, I went into becoming an evidence technician, you know, the CSI, what they call it now, was a property crimes investigator, a violent crime investigator, went into the SWAT team, was a founding member of that in 1980, did that for a few years, spent about 8 or 9 years as the training officer, which got me to a lot of schools and got promoted, went to internal affairs, went to be a full-time trainer, did that for about 5 years, got promoted to lieutenant, was a violent crime commander, was a night patrol commander, and then ran an undercover drug task force for about 5 years before I wrapped up my career, and then retired and went to work on a contract basis for the Marshals Service for a few years. So I ended up putting in about 35 years with a wide variety of assignments, and have no regrets, no druthers. I did my working career exactly the way I wanted to. I would change some of the people I worked for, but I probably wouldn't have changed my career itself very much.
That's right. How about Dave? This is Stan, of course. In your department or your sheriff's department, how many members were there? How many officers or deputies?
It was about a 500 person department. It was a large department for Ohio. You know, mm-hmm. certainly not a large department compared to some of the big cities, but, you know, Columbus and Cleveland would be the big cities in Ohio, and they probably had 1,000+ members at the time. So for Ohio, it was a reasonably good-sized department, and I got the opportunity for a wide variety of assignments, mm-hmm. But not so large I got lost.
Yes, yes. You know, that's the one thing, like with Oklahoma City Police Department, you know, it's about 950, 1,000 sworn officers, I believe. But, you know, the good thing about a medium-sized department or sheriff's department, PD or sheriff's department, is the fact that you can make a lot of lateral moves and you get a lot of training. And it's amazing, you know, how if you are aggressive with it, I mean, your resume could really be impressive, and you can put in a lot of time on, you know, use of force and firearms training. And like, it's really, really, it really works out well. You know, I love to put my resume against those across the nation. And, you know, many times I can only find, you know, those that work LAPD Metro to actually match me. So, I love training as a whole. But did you ever have an opportunity to be a training officer at the sheriff's department? I don't know if I heard that or not.
I was the training supervisor for 5 years.
Awesome. Awesome.
And that was one of my more favorite assignments. But mm-hmm. yeah, and I had bosses that were very supportive of me, not only of the training, but of the writing that I was doing at the time. And they sent me to quite a few schools and training conferences, and I got to travel around. There ain't too many guys that get to go to Alaska, you know, for a training
wow.
conference, but they were, they were pretty good. They were pretty good to me and allowed me to pursue a lot of talents. As a matter of fact, when I was promoted to lieutenant, mm-hmm. the sheriff had me in his office. And of course, you know, you got to raise your right hand and swear in all over again. And he told me, he says, look, don't give up your training contacts. Don't give up your training, because there's life after the sheriff's office. And I took him serious on that. And so even yeah. though when I was a lieutenant, I was not really involved in training very much, I stayed involved in training on my own personally. And I was always glad I did.
Awesome. Now, which firearm did you start off with when you got hired?
A Smith & Wesson Model 28 357 Magnum.
Yeah, and that was pretty standard across the nation, I believe, right, Mike?
Yeah.
Pretty standard. And then, so you said you got on in 76, Dave?
Yes.
Okay,
that's when I entered the police, or the Sheriff's Academy.
Well, I'm not trying to date you, but, you know, I was still peeing in the bed back then. I was just 6 years old.
Well, I'll save everybody a whole bunch of mathematics. I'm 64, so I'm not a kid.
No, you're not. I love it. Yeah, that's yeah. great. And then, so when did you guys transition over to semi-autos?
I actually pioneered that transition. I wrote the report, and I used, as a matter of fact, I used LAPD and their transition program a lot for that. Mm-hmm. But we made the initial transition, and our initial transition was like you could purchase it yourself and put yourself through the training program. And that started in 1986.
Awesome. 1986.
It was kind of
you know
a funny
what?
Thing.
Good.
What?
No, go ahead.
I was going to say the program was kind of strange because Dayton was very much a General Motors town. A lot of the General Motors components were here. And we had a very wealthy agency that bought Volvos for cruisers. And the backlash on that was pretty extensive. So when we went to pistols, the sheriff looked at me and said, okay, we're going to do this, but it's got to be an American-made gun. Mm-hmm. Well, the only one was Smith & Wesson. So we started out with Smith & Wesson 69s, and then very shortly thereafter, 6906s.
Cool. Yeah, and
there was no Glocks or SIGs or any of that stuff. We weren't even allowed to look at them.
That's right.
So how long did that last?
After I retired. Well, I shouldn't say that. They issue Glocks now.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was, I would say, during my tenure as training, we started a personal purchase program where you could buy your own gun. And there was a very extensive list of guns that you could purchase. But the only one that wasn't approved was 1911. They didn't want any cocked and locked pistols.
Mm-hmm.
But people could buy Glocks, and they could buy HKs, and they could buy all the various guns. And so the Glocks and all those guns probably were starting to be approved in the mid-90s.
Okay.
But they continued to issue Smith & Wessons right up until I retired in 04.
Huh. Now, Dave, you have the people listening. Dave's website is handguncombatives.com. You have a lot of information there. You do training. Do you have any online training, or are you doing full just live training?
There's a YouTube channel that my son-in-law pretty much manages for me. We do training videos. I've never been on it, so I've not even sure what I know we've done a lot of videos over the years.
And what's your training schedule like?
I think when I was talking to you guys at SHOT Show, I mentioned to you, I'm kind of reeling the training back. I was doing 30, 35 classes a year. That's a lot of weekends on the road. This year, I've kind of reeled it back to about 20 or 22. I'm trying to keep it to like every other weekend. So, my first class of the year is not this coming weekend. It's the weekend after that. And then it goes pretty much every other weekend until late summer, fall, and then it's every weekend.
And is that
until about things?
What locations is that? Do you train all over?
All over the United States. Yeah, all over the United States. I don't go overseas. I've been asked to go, overseas. I just choose not to.
Yeah.
Number one, I hate flying. The idea of being on an airplane for 17 hours is not appealing to me.
Yeah.
And then I want to be able to speak the language and have my own guns and stuff. So I stay inside the United States.
Cool. People, check out his site. And if you're interested in training, and that's one of the things we're going to be talking about today, definitely check his site and his training schedule to see if he's going to be near you sometime. So we're going to talk now. We're talking with Dave out at the SHOT Show. He'll be on our site quite a bit in reference to HR 218, which is House Resolution 218, the LEOSA, Law Enforcement Safety Officers Act. We're going to be running some new programs specifically kind of targeting retired officers or former officers that qualify for HR 218. So you'll see Dave on our site more. And today we're going to kind of focus on that with training. HR 218 is, for those, if you don't know, if you've had currently it's 10 years of experience or 10 years of service with a police department or law enforcement agency, and you left that agency honorably, then you're eligible for HR 218, which allows you to carry in all 50 states. So, a lot of people like me, for example, and I don't know, Stan, if you went through updated training, but, I was trained like in Weaver stance. For a lot of officers, can we talk a little bit about that, about your thoughts on, somebody who might have 20 to 30 years of law enforcement experience, and now they're entering into a civilian role, civilian life. And, you know, based on what training or limited training they may have had, what recommendations do you have, Dave?
Well, you know, if they haven't been to the range in quite a while, I mean, let's face it, because most cops, even on-duty cops, the only firearms training they get is, you know, their annual qualification, which, you know, maybe 1, 2, 3 times a year.
Right.
You know, even if you go 6 times a year, which is extensive for the average police department, you know, I would ask you, would you bet $5 on a quarterback that practiced with the ball 6 times a year? No. If you wouldn't bet $5 on that, then why are you betting your life on it? You know what I'm saying? Right. I mean, everybody needs to, you know, be honest with themselves and bolster up their training. And it may be just a one-day class. Just go out there and get refreshed. I teach a class I call Essential Pistol, where most of it is just grip and trigger and getting the gun between you and the threat. And that may be enough for somebody that's been carrying a gun for 30 years, but they need to go back and get refreshed. Better yet, go back and get a 2 or 3 day training course from one of the better known instructors. You know, hell, even if you get some training from one of the local guys, anytime you can put the gun in your hand and work the trigger, it will be to your benefit. So if they haven't done it in a while, they need to do it, because the annual qualification based on the state could be anywhere from 8 to 50 rounds.
Right.
That's just a qualification program. And let's face it, you may have gotten qualified, but if your target looked like a 12 gauge went off, then you need to get some gunfighter training, and you need to do it now, because we're not talking about making an arrest on somebody here. We're talking about you defending your life or the life of someone you care about.
Yeah.
And that is serious stuff, and you need to shoot relatively well.
Agreed. And with HR 218, you have to qualify. Is it I think it's once a year, isn't it? Annually? Yeah, or is it twice?
Just annually.
Just annually.
So you need to go back to an instructor who is certified in the state in which you reside and get qualified. You need to have proof of qualification that you need to carry with you.
So what are some of the drills? You know, I know a lot of people go to the range and just they'll take a 100 rounds or 200 rounds. They'll go to the range and just kind of put it on the paper. Are there any specific drills that you recommend if somebody's going, let's say, once a month or every other month to the range on their own? Is there anything you would recommend?
Well, you know, I always laugh at one of the more commonly made statements. What should I practice? Well, you should practice the stuff you stink at. Well, if you're not getting to the range very much, you stink at all of it. I mean, come on, let's be honest. So, you know what? Let's first of all dismiss the fundamental word. They're essential skills. They're absolutely necessary. So, you know what? Those are the skills that you should practice. And it isn't real hard to research gunfights anymore. All you got to do is go on YouTube or LiveLink and see what happens.
Yeah.
So let's look at the most essential of essentials. First of all, your state of mind. You got to be ready and willing and able to employ that pistol. And many people are not. But the first thing you got to do is you got to see the threat coming. So you got to be aware and willing.
Yeah.
Okay. That's tough to teach. So let's just jump over that. So if we jump over that, what's the most essential of essentials? Getting the gun between you and them. You know, everybody talks about all of this stuff about high-speed tactical spec op skills. Well, you know what? In a close-quarter pistol fight, it's merely getting the gun between you and them, whether it's coming from a ready position or a holster. And let's face it, in an off-duty or a retired officer capacity, you're going to see the threat. It's probably going to be coming from the holster. So drawing, from the holster in a reasonably quick manner, getting the gun between you and the threat and controlling the trigger in such a way that you don't move the muzzle, may be in one sentence what you need to focus on most.
I love that.
So what do you have any recommendations on carry as far as positioning?
Yeah, what you've done for most of your career.
Yeah.
I see a lot of guys, and I should preface this with, I really don't have anything against appendix carry. I'm not much for the abdominal carry where it's right out in front of your navel.
Right.
But the classic appendix carry, as established by Bruce Nelson many years ago, is more to the side of your abdomen, which is where a lot of us carried our little snubby revolvers. So, you know, but if you've been carrying strong side in a duty holster for the last 30 years, then strong side in a concealment holster is probably where you should be carrying. Now, you know, whether you're carrying at 2:30, 3 o'clock, 3:30, I really don't care, but I think a drastic change in your carry location is just going to lead to a certain amount of muscular confusion that's going to delay your draw. So do what you normally do. Now, if you want, okay, you like the idea of maybe having a little bit more forward and carrying kind of an appendix, fine. Then go to the range and create a familiar task transference that will allow you to do that without that muscular confusion. But if you're going to change drastically, you're going to have to commit to that new location. You're going to have to practice it. Fortunately, most of that can be done in dry fire. It's just 5 or 10 minutes a day.
I was going to ask if you recommend dry fire training or like the cards or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Dry fire. I mean, let's think about guys, because you guys have got extensive firearms training. With the exception of the marriage of the hand, the finger on the trigger, and the recoil control. All the other stuff can be done dry fire.
Right.
Your draw stroke, your clearing a malfunction, your reloading, all of that stuff can be done dry fire. And with some of these dry fire trainers where you got the laser device and in the muzzle and it reads it on the target center, you can get a lot of those essential skills drilled down. And I do that a lot. The only thing you really need live fire for is that bat, 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 where you're working the recoil. You know, you're resetting the trigger on recovery so that when the gun is on target, ready to press the trigger again. That's what requires the live fire. So if a guy's only got 50 rounds, that's what you work on. Then go home dry fire and work the draw, the reload, clear the malfunction, all that stuff.
Have you tried any of these? Have you tried any of those products that the dry fire products, whether it be the cards or the laser type?
All bunches of them. I mean, even especially when I was doing the gun writing for the magazines, you would get these things sent to you. And what I have found, and again, we're just talking about Dave Spaulding's humble opinion, because there's going to be somebody out there that disagrees or has a product I don't know about.
Sure.
But the simpler the product, the better. What I tended to like was the one where you just put the laser down the barrel and you would draw and you would shoot a target that would be 3x5, 5x7, and it would just go beep. So then I know I got a hit. A unit that I'm working with right now, and I hope I get it right, I believe it's the Kieron, K-E-I-R-O-N. They sent it to me, and it's just such a device. I put a module down, or actually, this one's like a bullet that I actually put in the chamber. And then the striker hits it, and it sends a laser. And the target was relatively big. I put tape on it to narrow it down to a 3x5 card, because I like 3x5 card-sized targets. And I've been able to do a lot of pretty good work. Now, no, you don't get multiple shots, because I use a striker-fired Glock. But you know what? I get to work that first critical shot from the holster already or after the reload quite a bit, and I kind of like that. Simple, effective, it works off batteries, and you know, if it quits working, it's usually because I got to change the batteries.
And what product is it? What one is that? Do you know?
I think it's called a Keiron, K-E-I-R-O-N. You guys probably are on your computers. You can look it up.
Yeah, I'll look that up.
It's a K-E-I-R-O or O-I-N, I believe it is. They sent it to me, asked me to try it, and I've been playing around with it for the last few months, and I kind of like it.
Cool. I never have used any of those. I do a lot of dry fire. Not a lot, but I do some dry fire training with mine. But I've wondered about those, how they work and what the different ones are. I have to pull that up, and I'll put that if I can find it. I'll put it in the show notes of this show.
The more elaborate the unit, the less reliable it tends to be. I had a unit that came out of Israel years ago. I think it was just called a bullet. And it was a similar unit where you had a rod, you put down the barrel, and all it came with was some reflective discs that were about 2 inches in diameter. And this unit came in a tin that looked like an Altoids tin.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even think they're available anymore. But it was designed so you could take the thing with you and dry fire in a hotel room. And that was a pretty neat little unit, because if you got on the disc and you held the trigger and you got the laser on the disc, there was like this flash. And if you didn't, of course, there would be dead, because the laser would just go into the wall and there'd be no reflective flash.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that thing was pretty neat. The reason I don't use it anymore is because the module went bad and I haven't been able to find anything that works like it. So now that I mention it, I bet this thing I've got now would work with those reflective discs.
Mm.
And, you know, those reflective discs could be a square of aluminum foil. I mean, you can do all kinds of great things with dry fire just playing around with it.
Mm.
Hey, Dave, I wanted to also ask you about what's your thought on utilizing, like, a training weapon for close quarter, you know, practicing to get the firearm between you and the suspect. Do you do any of that?
Blue guns, orange guns, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I think that stuff is great. These guns are so much more accurate than the original dummy guns. I mean, as far as sizing and how they feel, than they used to be. My buddy Rich Nance, who does a lot of that type of close quarter weapon retention type training, yeah, he's a big believer in those blue guns. But, you know, nowadays, they've even got these plastic rods that basically just block your real firearm. So you can now, BladeTech. BladeTech actually has a replacement barrel insert that you can actually use your real gun. So you've got the dangers of getting your hand ripped on the real front sight.
Got you.
You know, that kind of stuff is a factor in it. So I kind of like that idea. I know guys that do that type of training with real guns, and they just basically rope the gun. They'll put a piece of rope down the barrel so that it, you know, goes up through the magazine well and out the barrel so the gun cannot be loaded.
Yes.
So, you know, there's a lot of things out there you can do with your actual real gun. And if you're worried about getting your hands torn on the sights and stuff, just put duct tape over them. But there's no reason that you can't do that type of training. It's just too easy to do.
Yeah. Now I know you just mentioned one trainer, but who's a trainer that you respect that started in law enforcement and now full-time trainer?
Well, my mentor has stopped. That's Ken Akathorn.
Mm. Oh, yeah, we love Ken.
I mean, he was here in Ohio for most of my career, and we crossed paths back and forth, and he was probably the first writer that I followed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when it comes to that kind of stuff, he was who I was the mentor. Now, people who are currently active that are doing excellent training, well, you know, like Larry Vickers, you know, from the military side of it, Jeff Gonzalez, you know, guys that you guys know well, you know, they're doing great programs. I hate to recommend people that I actually haven't been to their classes, because then I'm being disingenuous. So, you know, from my generation, Gunsight. you know, the guys at gun sites, Thunder Range, you know, those, those are places that I have been. The SIG Academy, a place that I've been. I was actually an instructor at the Tactical Defense Institute here in Ohio. And what John Benner and his guys are doing down there is excellent training. And they do a lot of classes just for law enforcement agencies only. So those are the people that I would recommend, but it's because I have been to their classes. You know, a lot of the currently popular trainers from internet and all that kind of stuff. I hate to say yes or no, because I haven't been to their class. So I'll just kind of defer and stand back.
Okay. That's fair.
Now, you were talking earlier about, you and Ken were talking earlier about kind of what we're talking about today. Is there something you can talk about what you guys were discussing?
I know we talked about this. Refresh my memory what we were doing, because I'm old.
About that. About the training in law enforcement kind of over the years.
Yeah. The latest thing right now in law enforcement training is the tactical patrol officer. Well, that's not a new concept. We called it SWAT on patrol. And basically what you were trying to do is basically ratchet up officers' awareness and their capabilities and stuff like that, because there's a lot of agencies out there that you can't call a SWAT team that'll get there in the next hour. You know, they are it. So, you know, the idea of having a carbine and heavier armor and giving these guys a higher level of tactical training other than just officer survival type stuff is sound. But at the same time, I like to caution my young officers that you, and this is going to be real unpopular, it's going to tick a lot of guys off, but you're not going to Afghanistan.
You're not
in Fallujah. So the idea that you're now a special operator, I am reluctant to go that direction, because we are now, Jesus, I want to make sure I say this well. We are now in an era where police activity is watched with a very jaundiced eye. And officers are going to be taking action. They are going to be on film. There's going to be camera. So the idea that a police officer launches out, he's got his AR-15 and 47 magazines, and he unloads on this guy, he may go to jail. If and that sound, oh no, you don't know what you're talking about. You're old and out of it. I worked internal affairs, and I know that some of the stuff that's currently being taught is going to get some guys in trouble. So when you're building your skill sets, I hate to use the term toolbox, when you're building your skill sets, keep in mind that you are not the military. You're not killing the enemy. You police society. And society expects you to use deadly force as only a last resort, and when it is utilized, it is to be done. Amendment of the Constitution, and that means it has to be reasonable in nature. And just because a guy comes up with a gun doesn't mean you get to drain an AR magazine into his chest cavity. There is a look factor to your deadly force that is going to be there. And I know people are going to think I'm out of touch and I'm against officers and all that. I am not against officers. But that officer not only has to win on the street, he has to win in the court of public opinion, and he has to win in the courts themselves.
That's right.
And I'll say one more thing on this, and it's going to be unpopular. But it's not going to just be a Fourth Amendment reasonableness standard. In the beginning, you're going to be judged on the basis of how it looked on video. Was there a minority involved? How old was that minority? Is the prosecutor in your jurisdiction seeking higher political office? Did CNN take an interest in it? There's a whole lot of factors that are going to be involved in this. And though we may not want to think about those things, and especially trainers who are teaching cool looking stuff, you need to be taking that stuff into account, or somewhere down the road, you may be sorry.
Right.
Well, I guess we're probably, Stan and I are probably aligned with your assessment and thinking. I don't think that that's any anti-law enforcement or anything like that. I think it's exactly right. And I think that the training, not only in firearms, but I think a lot of the training in law enforcement today is not what is best for officers who are put into certain situations. And you mentioned earlier,
I didn't mean it to sound anti-law enforcement. What I meant to say is it's going to be unpopular with the 20, maybe 30 something cop.
Right.
Who wants to do this stuff and wants to view his potential confrontation militaristically.
Right.
I think that's ill-advised.
Well, and I think that that's also applicable to other areas of training. for example, what Stan and I had more involvement in was defensive tactics. And that's a whole nother topic. But one thing you mentioned earlier too, which I totally agree with, is fundamentals. And whether it's defensive tactics, whether it's firearms, whatever. You know, I had a judo school for about 20 years. And, you know, one of the biggest things I saw, you know, when you look at Olympic level, world level competitors, you know, the one thing that every top competitor does, whether it's defensive tactics, whether it's jiu-jitsu, judo, whether it's firearms, whether it's tennis, the top people do one thing better than anybody else, and that's the basics, and that's fundamentals. So I think
the foundation,
a huge role in that.
The foundation of all of these things is so important. It's just like the concrete foundation of your house. It has to be established. It has to be established well. One of my favorite quotes came from a very well-known martial artist, Bruce Lee, because very early on in the 1960s, he saw a lot of this stuff for what it really was when it came to fighting. Mm-hmm. And when he made the statement, advanced skills are the basics mastered, kind of hard to argue that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Well, a lot of the things you're talking about, too, especially for law enforcement, there's body cams now, there's in dash cam video stuff. But a lot of the stuff you're talking to also is going to apply to a citizen or a police officer who is now into a citizen role, and he's a citizen of society, and now he's carrying a firearm, whether it be under HR 218 or whether it's through a permit. And, you know, I think a lot of people think, and I see this a lot, you see this on discussions and threads and boards and stuff where people are like, oh, well, police get away with whatever. Well, police are held to the same, well, actually a higher standard, but they're held to the same standards that a citizen involved in a shooting is going to be held to, but they also have to be held to their policies and procedures and guidelines. So, you know, all this that you're talking about is going to be applicable to a lot of our members who are listening to this podcast who are not former law enforcement, but who are just, you know, concealed carriers.
Well, you know, someone that says law enforcement gets away with stuff, you know, from my personal experience, I was investigated by internal affairs. I investigated cops as internal affairs, and I was also involved in use of force lawsuit. Okay. Mm-hmm. And anybody that says that is full of crap.
Yeah.
Because police use of force is looked at extensively, not only by the agency, but by the prosecutor, and also sometimes by the state's attorney general.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, it is the armed citizen, hating the term, that's likely to get away mm-hmm. with something more than the cop. because they're not looked at as stringently as the agent of the government. So that's a load of crap. But you know what? When an armed citizen's looking at the skill sets they're going to develop, I think they're, oh God, here I'm going to get myself in trouble again. I think they are much more wise to look at the law enforcement use of that tools or skills than the spec ops
use
of those tools or skills. Nothing against the special operators. Man, they are out there. They're doing it. They got their lives in danger. And most of the time, you know, it's like the intelligence community. You have no idea what they're doing and how dangerous it is. But again, they're killing the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what legally armed citizens and police do. They defend themselves, and they have to do it judiciously. So, you know, you want to be careful of that stuff.
Well, we've told people for a long time that when they're looking at ammunition, when they're looking at firearms, and even training to a certain point, but more so about firearms and ammunition, they should look at what law enforcement in their area carries, because it's been vetted. The firearms have been vetted. The ammunition has been vetted. So we've long said that, you know, is what you should, if you're in the market to buy a new firearm, you don't know what to buy, look at what law enforcement in your area is carrying.
Sure, because it is. It probably works.
Yeah.
So I absolutely agree with you. And I got news for you. The military looks at what law enforcement does.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen that a lot over the years. So, you know, I mean, I've had, you know, former special operators in my classes, and I've had intelligence personnel, and of course, lots of cops and stuff like that. And when the conversation goes to equipment, it usually focuses on what does LE do, especially when it comes to the pistol. When it comes to the carbine, then it shifts to the military because that's what they do.
Right. So out at SHOT, is there anything that you saw? Did you have an opportunity to spend much time on the floors to see what?
Yeah, I walked the floor a little bit. I mean, I was mostly there for FTA and CCW Safe, but I walked the floor a little bit, and oh man, I cannot tell you how much I did not see anything I cared about.
Millions and millions.
It was
of
the
guns
most
that you didn't care about.
I've been going to SHOT since 1995, 96, when it was in Dallas, whatever year that was, and this was one of the more disappointing SHOT shows I've had. But the SHOT show is about guns and gear. That's what it's about. It's not about training and skill building and all. It's about guns and gear.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, your knowledge base, your skill sets and all that should certainly play a big factor in the gear that you select. And that's kind of how I look at a lot of this stuff. And I'll have to tell you, I didn't see very much that excited me. There really wasn't a whole lot new. The Glock 48, 43X, that was probably the one thing that developed some buzz, because it was Glock's rounding out of their product line. I mean, they've pretty much got a product now for just about any carry or function you would want. There was a number of Glock 19 size pistols from the various manufacturers, because I think everybody realizes that 19 size gun is big enough and small enough for just about everything you could need. I saw a couple of flashlights, and I was kind of intrigued by Aimpoint's mini red dot. You know, a lot of people say it's too big and all that, but you know, it's the direction this is going, because it's a totally encased unit. I mean, so many of the mini red dot sights on pistols right now are just a mud clot away from stopping working.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, or a rainstorm. So, you know, that's the direction it will go if you want something that's totally reliable. But no, for the most part, I was pretty underwhelmed by what I saw. And, you know, blah.
That's what I heard from several people, that they weren't too impressed with the show this year, or with what they saw. So I'd like to get your, just before we wrap it up, I'd like to get your, what if you were to buy a new, say, Glock 19 Gen 5? you're a Glock
guy. A very good gun.
Glock 19?
I became a Glock guy screaming and kicking because guns were not made out of plastic and they have a hammer on them.
Yeah.
So that was my mentality. But, you know, you start playing around with the Glock, you start looking at the Glock, you see how the Glock works. It's pretty foolproof.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And the fifth gen Glock, I agree with Ken and Larry. I think it's about as foolproof a pistol as we can get.
Mm-hmm.
So that would. Say a Glock 19 fifth gen. The only thing I would like to see Glock do, and they've done a pretty good job of reducing the size of that grip. But like I told the folks at Glock, I would really like to see a 1911-ish type grip configuration, which would mean the grip in its smallest form, I mean, without any back straps on it, that the front strap and back strap would be parallel. The front strap, back strap, that would be very 1911-ish for me. And that's what I have done to my personal Glocks. I have the grip reduction done so they're parallel. And that works very good. It feels like a 1911 in my hand. If they could do that, I could probably use a stock Glock.
So that's what I was going to ask you. What things do you do? If you get a brand new Glock in, what do?
I put new sights on it because we all realize the plastic sights are just for importation.
Yeah.
So I'd get rid of those. I'd go to Ameriglow sights, give them a shameless plug. Put a pair of high visibility Ameriglow sights on it. I would probably have the back strap reduced. I don't even have to have the whole grip texture. I would just have the back strap reduced so it's parallel. Because I'm finicky and I like the best trigger I can get, I would probably take the trigger components out and I'd give them a good polishing so they would glide back and forth nicely. And beyond that, I would shoot the gun and be happy.
Now, have you used any trigger scissors like Apex?
I tried all of those triggers, and they're a nice product, and I think they're very reliable. I don't buy into the whole liability centric. Oh my God, you're going to go to prison and die and be prosecuted be sued because you've changed the trigger. I'm not a flat-faced trigger guy. I guess probably because of all the years of short and curved triggers from revolvers to Smith & Wesson's to SIGs to HKs and all that. A curved trigger feels comfortable to me. Mm-hmm. So I don't switch them out for that reason. I think the curved one's fine. So all I really want is a smooth trigger. I'm not really interested in a light trigger per se.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've done enough of Glock triggers and I've been an armor I don't know how many times now, but I know how to smooth them and stuff like that. I do like the Ghost connectors that have the little over travel tab on them. There's one my kids sell on their store, the Cat Trigger combative application trigger that has a pre-cut over travel tab. It's a 4.5-pound connector. You can slap that in there. But, you know, if you put a heavier striker and trigger spring in the Glock, you can get that thing up to, you know, 5, 5.5, 6 pounds in case you're all liability phobic. And, you know, that kind of simple stuff right there is all you really need to do to the Glock, in my humble opinion. Some people will tell you shoot it stock, and that's fine, too.
Yeah. Well, I think Stan had one question before we go.
Yeah, Dave, I always like to ask this question, especially someone, you know, of your tenure and the amount of experience that you have in law enforcement. But have you ever personally been involved in a shooting where you defend yourself or another person, for one, on duty? And second to that, if you had to estimate how many times you pulled your weapon on people, what would that be?
Pulling your gun and pointing it at somebody? A lot. I mean, because, you know, I worked at, you know, when I retired, the Dayton, Ohio area was the seventh most violent city in the nation per capita.
Really?
So, wow. You know, I worked in an active area. It was a good, fun place to be a cop. I mean, we weren't overwhelmed with crime or anything like that, but yeah. It was a good place. So action calls and point your gun at people a lot. Mm-hmm. Did I have to use my firearm to defend myself? Yeah, I mean, I work narcotics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's just part and parcel of it. And the thing about using your pistol in law enforcement is, it's my opinion that those types of stories aren't all that educational, because mm-hmm. if you drew your gun, it's probably because you screwed up.
Yeah.
You put yourself in a bad position, and now you're having to do this to get yourself out of it. So those kind of situations are really, in police work, unfortunate. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I had some situations where I had to calling and pointing guns and giving commands. It has to be hundreds, if not thousands of times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was nights you did that multiple times, depending on where you worked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, what I find really surprising, especially with citizens, when they look at law enforcement officers, you know, I mean, you get these national cases that, you know, draw attention with, you know, to national news. But, you know, they don't realize, you know, how many times that officers de-escalate themselves or, you know, they're really trained so not to put themselves in that position. You know, I think it happens, you know, so much more than what people would think. And, you know, I mean, we are kind of the standard for, you know, using your firearm as a last resort. You know what I mean?
Sure. And let's face it, the vast majority of police shootings, mm-hmm. no one's hit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right about that.
No one is
because of piss poor training too, though.
Well, it's because of cops don't expect it to happen. They panic. They're minimally to moderately trained. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we all talk about the cop shootings where someone's killed. I'll bet you there's 8 to 10 times more where rounds are exchanged and no one's hit. So let me ask you this. Since no one was killed, was he involved in a gunfight?
Well,
I would say yes. I mean, definitely was. Yeah.
Especially, you know,
with a lot of cops out there
have
been in gunfights. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I mean, law enforcement anymore is big business, and you have to look at it like a corporation, because that's how they run it. You know, it changed. Mm-hmm. I think it changed over in the mid-90s, but, you know, at the end of the 80s, which I'm sure you were able to identify, is that there were some significant changes that went on in the late 80s, and, you know, reference to the standard and different things like that. So, but
1985 to 1989, the Graham versus Connor and the Garner versus Tennessee decisions, as far as force, changed everything. I was on law enforcement where you could hit people in the head with a flashlight.
Yeah.
And it was a given. And you know what? It was a very effective technique, because even though it looked bad, because, you know, the capillaries are just right at the surface when you hit somebody in the forehead and it looks like their head explodes.
Yeah.
But they go down quickly. Very seldom are they ever seriously hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And I guarantee you $1,000, the next time you see that suspect, he will call you sir. I know that for a fact from personal experience. But you know what? It looks cruel, mean, and heartless. You know, with doing that kind of, I'm a big believer in hand-to-hand combat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it kind of morphed into defensive tactics. And the last time I knew, here in Ohio, it was called response to resistance. What the hell is that? But you know what? You can teach a hammer fist to the bridge of someone's nose, mm-hmm. very quickly, they retain it a long time, and it does very little physical damage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the cost and savings of just teaching a technique like that is immense over putting them through a taser program, buying a taser. The taser may not work. And if it does work, they fall flat on their face and break their nose anyway.
Yeah, you're right. You know, I watched the transition over the past 15 years, you know, when they started adding, you know, expandable batons and the pepper spray, you know, on each officer and the taser and beanbag guns and different things like that. And the problem is, you know, you end up running into an issue where these officers start looking at it as, it becomes a crutch. And that they're no longer, even the trainers are not training the hand-to-hand combat any longer, you know, showing an officer that just because you get punched in the face in, you know, this sterile environment, you know, it will prepare you for if you get punched in the face in the field and you know that you can make it through it. But, you
and
know,
we need
a lot
to do
of
that.
Listen, we do.
We need to do that kind of stuff. But you know what? How many times have you seen in the video somebody shoots somebody with a taser and it doesn't work? They have no idea what to do.
Yep.
Or better yet, OC spray. What we did with officers and OC spray, we did that all wrong because we told them about it's got 2 million Scoville heat units and it's going to do this to your eyes and your mucous membranes. And then we made them wait in line to get sprayed and they're standing there and they're shaking and shit. And then when you do spray them, they're like, oh my God, ah! And they run over to the stuff and they're washing their face. And then they shoot a suspect in the face with it. And they stand there and look at them, licking their lips. And it's like, oh, my God, what do I do now?
Yeah, it's crazy.
The ass baton. It's a hollow metal tube. Any expandable baton's a hollow metal tube. Okay, we can't hit them with a flashlight, but we can hit them with this expandable hollow metal tube. And it's totally ineffective unless you hit them in the locations that they tell you don't hit them in because it'll cause too much damage.
That's right.
You hit somebody in the thigh with a hollow metal tube, what do you expect them to do besides stand there and look at you?
Yeah, you're right.
Now, you hit them in that thigh with a solid piece of hickory,
they'll know. All right, but you need to end on that one. That was a good one.
I still have my original hickory baton. It was good.
Do you really?
Yes, I do. I still have my sap gloves, too.
I was just going to ask, do you still have your sap?
They were called safety gloves.
Safety gloves. There you go.
Yeah, so you didn't hurt your hands doing whatever.
That's funny. Well, man, thank you for coming on. We're going on right at an hour, so we're going to wrap this up. But, Dave, it's great to have you on. To our listeners and our members, like I said, you're going to start seeing Dave on some videos. He's helping us with the HR 218 rollout. And thanks for your time, Dave. We appreciate it.
Glad to be here, but I am going to sign off because I'm headed to the range.
Hey, thanks, Dave.
Go get it.
Bye-bye. You guys have a good one. Take care.
You too. All right.